Hey, everybody, I'm Nick Layton.
And I'm Leah Bonema.
And we're the hosts of Were You Raised by Wolves?
Each week, we try to make the world a kinder, nicer place.
Well, that's the idea, at least.
I mean, we try.
Have you ever wondered what to do if you're ghosted?
Or what to do when a friend asks you to borrow money?
Or the proper way to eat Cheetos?
You know, the big questions.
So please find Were You Raised by Wolves wherever you listen.
Today's program has been brought to you by Underground Meats, an American producer of handcrafted salami and cured meats in Madison, Wisconsin. For more information, visit shop.undergroundfoodcollective.org or stop by their butcher shop in Madison, Wisconsin. You're listening to Heritage Radio Network, broadcasting live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. If you like this program, visit heritageradionetwork.org for thousands more. Good evening and welcome to
Foment About It
on HeritageRadioNetwork.org.
I'm Barry Izette.
My name is Chris Kuzmi.
And we're your co-hosts for this journey through all things fermented on Heritage Radio Network every Monday night live at 7 p.m.
And if you don't catch us live at 7 p.m., you can catch us archived on iTunes and at HeritageRadioNetwork.org. Barry, what's going on next week or in life?
Next week? Well, November 2nd is the New York City Homebrewers Guild 25th anniversary party. It's basically a homebrew extravaganza at the Brooklyn Brewery. It's from 9 to 11:45.
9 to 11:45. Our curfew is 12:30, so we're going to have a giant party at Brooklyn Brewery. It's going to feature all of the New York City homebrew clubs that are able to make it and share homebrew. It's basically going to be a homebrew beer festival in celebration of our 25th year as the guild.
Yep, there will be over, so far we have 60 different homebrews on this sheet, and there definitely will be at least 10, 15, 20, 25 more. Tickets are
$25 for 25 years. New York City Homebrewers Guild are going to serve 25 beers.
And that will also net you a ticket, all you can taste of excellent local homebrews, as well as our 25th anniversary gold rim Belgian tulip glass.
And I'll be cheersing at least 25 times that night.
Oh, undoubtedly, good Lord.
In multiples of 25 hugs goodbye, too.
And then on November 5th, I am teaching my first alternative fermentation class at Brooklyn Homebrew. It's $40. I'm going to teach you how to culture your own kombucha from a bottle. We're going to talk about water kefir, whey fermented sodas, short meads, and all kinds of other alternative fermented beverages. So we'll put the link up on the webpage when I update it. But please go to Brooklyn Homebrew and sign up for my alternate fermentation class on November 5th if you're interested in learning more.
But that's all local stuff. So for the rest of you, homebrewers and people alike, our first guest today is from Y-East Laboratories. Greg Doss, how are you doing, man?
Hey, I'm doing well, Chris. It's Mary, how are you guys doing?
Great.
Fantastic. Good. Did you make it to GABF as well this weekend?
You know, I did not make it. This is the first year I haven't made it in, I think, the last five or six have been out there. We had a couple other people go, and I had some stuff going on around here, so I did not make it out. Did you guys make it?
That's why you're coherent right now.
Yeah, exactly. Well, use that term loosely.
Yeah, right. We did not make it. No, there's stuff here to be going on. We actually enjoyed ourselves at the Brooklyn Pour, a local homebrew festival, and we've represented ourselves here, did a talk on brewing in small spaces.
Yep.
Oh, nice. Oh, very cool.
That was very fun. To brew in small spaces, you always need yeast. Greg Doss, you are the quality control manager and
microbiologist.
It's a long word for me to say.
And you guys have a private collection, which we've talked about before, but you have three pretty exciting special releases that just came out, I guess, last week, right? The beginning of October?
It did, yeah. It did. This is our fourth quarter. And we've got two strains that have been on in the past, and that's 1768 English Special Bitter and a 3726 Farmhouse. So we have issued those or released those in the past. This quarter, we also have our 1217 West Coast IPA, and this is the first time releasing this strain.
Great. So tell us a little bit about West Coast IPA. What makes that strain special for real
sure.
Happy beers?
Sure. Well, it's actually a pretty versatile strain, and it can be used in darker beers as well. But, you know, what makes it real nice for IPA is that it doesn't really get in the way of the hops. And so it's a fairly clean fermentation. It still is an English strain and has medium to medium-high flocculation. But it definitely keeps kind of that British character subdued and doesn't really get in the way of bringing out those nice citrusy notes that you may want in an IPA.
So if you were to compare that to 1056,
yeah,
you would call it a little bit fruitier?
I'd call it a little more fruity and definitely a little more flocculent.
Mm-hmm.
I guess definitely in a little bit more, but a little bit more flocculent. And so, you know, I really compare it to 1098, which is our British strain, and a strain that I use a lot, actually. And I like it in an IPA. It also is a versatile strain, but I think I prefer that in kind of a darker beer, whether it's a porter, stout, brown. It really kind of brings out the malt characters. This 1217 is kind of along those lines. It will work with those darker beers and malt, but it doesn't interfere with the hops, and that's what makes it, you know, really nice for, you know, kind of a wide range of beers, and really nice in an IPA where you may be wanting just a little more fruit or a little bit of yeast character to call, you know, with the hopping.
Right. All right. What would you recommend? Or what temperature does it ferment out at?
You know, I think we've got 62 to 74. You know, with a lot of these strains, I'll run them at 62 to 64 for the first, you know, 48 hours or so.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm looking for about 30% attenuation. Then after that, you figure majority of growth and kind of the yeast byproducts are done, and really after that you're looking for fermentation, so then I'll boost that up to 68 to 70 to finish it out. And that way, you know, that's kind of my personal fermentation profile right now that I've been running. But I like a cleaner style beer, and that way you're subduing those yeast byproducts, yet really getting a nice, strong fermentation and attenuation in a reasonable amount of time.
Yeah.
Great. So let's talk a little bit about the English Special Bitter Ale.
Uh-huh.
You said you guys have had this out before, but what do you recommend? What makes that different from some of the other English ales that you guys have?
Like
sure.
The 1968, too.
Yeah, and that's probably the strain that would be most similar to. It's a little less flocculent than 1968. You know, and I think this brings out a little more of a nutty quality and maybe a little more complexity than the 1968. You know, 1968 is a fantastic strain, and in fact, it can also be used in a wide variety of beers. You know, really what people are looking for when they're using that strain is something that's going to really drop bright quickly. And this strain is kind of along those lines, but I think that it adds a little more complexity, maybe a little more nuttiness, and it's nice in an ESB, if you're looking for that kind of maltiness to come through. But as well, this is something that I'd probably push into darker beers as well.
So some English browns.
Oh, brown would be fantastic, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Browns, stouts, porters.
And then lastly, your farmhouse ale, the 3726. So what makes this one different then? So if I was going to make a Saison, either a French or Belgian style Saison, why would I choose this farmhouse ale yeast over the other ones that are currently available?
Sure. So so some of our other strains, we've got our 3711 French Saison, 3724. I think it's just called Belgian Saison, and that mm-hmm. has origins of DuPont. And so 3724 is really a finicky strain. It has a very a unique profile that you really can't get with any other strain, but at the same time, it's really, really difficult to work with. And there's a lot of people that have used it know that it will attenuate to about 50 to 60% and then seemingly stop. It will continue to ferment, but at a very, very low rate. So what it does is it consumes the simple sugars pretty quickly, and then once it hits maltose and certainly maltotriose, then it really starts to slow down. It will eventually attenuate, and attenuate quite far, actually. It's a very attenuate strain. It just takes weeks to get there. On the homebrew scale, it's It is something that people can play around with. On the commercial scale, I usually recommend somebody go with something else. And you know, some of the alternatives would be the 3711, which is what we call our French saison. Mm-hmm. A little more estuary, but a workhorse, and it will ferment right through. And then this 3726 that we're releasing right now for our private collection also will ferment like a typical ale strain. I think it has a little more ester profile than 3711. And when I say ester, I'm probably pushing a little more to the isoamyl acetate, kind of the banana, but not in a negative, way. It does have kind of an earthy note that comes through as well, it's nice. It really is a nice trait to play around with if you are making those things on.
What temperature would you recommend for these guys? This has a pretty wide threshold, right? Depending on where you want to go.
Yeah, absolutely. And I would probably keep that around 70 degrees. You know, the lower end. We've got it right now set at 70 to 84. And all these strains, you can ferment them above or below those, you know, that range that we get. This is just kind of where we find that you have the nicest profile aroma and flavor profile. But I think I would run that probably at a 70 degree, probably on the lower end, and maybe not push too much ester. But you know, after it gets going, and maybe similar to what I was mentioning with the ale strain, the 1217, that I might start there, and then after 30-40% attenuation, then let it ramp up a little bit higher and finish out. Mm-hmm. One thing with the strain that is kind of interesting that you can see some flotation, and this doesn't happen with all beers, but flotation meaning that you can get a lot of yeast on the top of the beer and maybe less actually inside. And so when you look at say a glass carboy, you may see somewhat clear beer and a big yeast head on the top, and you know, that can be alleviated with the use of fermentation defoamer. Okay. Or just an agitation.
Mm-hmm. Shake it up, just kind of mix it up.
Yeah, exactly. But it's an interesting, and it doesn't happen with all fermentations, but we hear from time to time that it does kind of float on you, which isn't a bad thing. It's something that you might see.
You want to just encourage it to get those sugars that it's not in contact with and shake it up and get it back in suspension.
Exactly, just kind of break up that flock or that cap.
I just brewed a beer with the Belgian saison yeast, and it did kind of stop in the middle, and it was August, so I took it out and put it in the hall, and it was reaching up to 90 degrees in the basement over at 508 Castor Brewery, and then it just kicked ass all the way home, man.
Oh, nice, very nice.
Yeah,
how's it tasting right now?
Delicious. Yeah, it was great, and it had a lot of really nice esters and peppery notes, and it was rose hip and rosemary. Soft crack saison is what we called it, because I made a soft crack Belgian candy sugar where I infused rose hips into it.
Oh my goodness.
And threw that in there. It was very, very lovely.
Oh, nice. And it's gone?
It's gone. Well, actually, I have one. Right. I have one keg left. I have one small six-tool left. I don't know when I'm going to drink it, but it's around.
Oh, very cool. Oh, so you did that in the brewery?
Yeah, I did. Yeah.
Okay. Oh, good.
But I'm really excited. I'm definitely going to order. I'm going to order that American IPA strain. I'm very excited about that. I have a big confession. I mean, I've been saying it, I guess, a little bit out there, but I've never made an IPA until I started working at 508 Gastro Brewery. Because as a home brewer, like, you know, there are IPAs around there. It's a very popular style to make, and I never found myself in want of an IPA without an IPA around, you know? And now at the brewery, I have to, you know, I definitely want to have that as in the lineup, or at least in rotation.
Oh, absolutely.
And so I'm a rookie with IPAs and learn a lot about it right now.
Nice. He's doing a good job, though.
Wow, yeah. No complaints yet.
Well, thank you very much, Greg. And for those of you out there who have, please go to your local homebrew store or order from your homebrew online and look for these special collection strains. They're going to be available October through December, or as long as they last, depending. So please, you know, take a chance on some of these. They sound really great strains.
Yeah, Greg, how long can we expect these out there? the generally 3 months?
It is October, fourth quarter. Okay. And so October through December, and then starting in January, we will be releasing the first quarter of 2014.
Yeah. And hopefully we'll talk
to
you
again.
But I know
some of these go fast. I mean, I think that farmhouse ale, just because a lot of people really have had, you know, have trouble. They're a little intimidated by your Belgian Saison yeast, the DuPont strain. So I think that's, I know that goes pretty quickly at our local homebrew store. So get them while you can, for sure.
Well, we've had a real nice response with this quarter's release, and I'm actually kind of scrambling to catch up with demand right now. So it's been great. I think we're going to be sampling some really nice beers that are coming off of these strains.
Absolutely. Thank you again.
All right. Thank you so much. We'll see you soon, man, I hope.
Absolutely. I look forward to seeing you guys next time. I'm sure we'll run into you somewhere.
Yep. As it happens.
So, all right, Chris and Mary, thanks for the time.
Cheers, Greg. Thanks.
Thanks, Greg.
We're going to take a small break. When we come back on Ferment About, we have Josh Bernstein in the house. How you doing, Josh?
Making it happen.
Yeah. Ferment About it over here.
Underground Meats is an American producer of handcrafted salami and cured meats in Madison, Wisconsin. They use small farms from southwest Wisconsin to source their meat. The animals are raised on pasture for their entire lives by farmers who care about animal welfare. While Underground Meats uses European traditions, they also use ingredients from the upper Midwest to try to create new types of salamis, experimenting with both ingredients and techniques. The salamis are made using heritage breeds, mostly red wattles, tamworths, berkshires, and mule foots. Try their award-winning cured pork shoulder and goat salami. To learn more and purchase products, visit shop.undergroundfoodcollective.org or stop by their butcher shop in Madison, Wisconsin. Like what you hear so far? Support the network and become a member. Membership helps us bring you the best food radio in the world and gives you access to thousands of dollars in discounts at the sustainably minded businesses that support us. To become a member, visit heritageradionetwork.org today.
Welcome back to Ferment About It on HeritageRadioNetwork.org. So the first part of the show, we were talking to Greg Doss about the Y Yeast's special collection strain releases for October through December.
The private collections, right?
Yeah, the private collection. And now we're very fortunate to have Josh Bernstein just off a whirlwind GABF book tour TV appearance.
Some people call it a bender.
Except when you write about beer and it's work.
Right, it's research and development.
So if you don't know Josh Bernstein, you are my favorite beer writer.
Thank you, Mary.
It's hard because there are some very good writers, but you commonly write for Imbibe. You have two books out. Your second book just came out, The Complete Beer Course. And then you also lead some absolutely wonderful homebrew tours here
in New York City. Yeah, it's kind of well-rounded. You know, writing is a very alienating thing when you're back home by yourself with your dog, largely working pantsless in your apartment at home. And so it's good to actually have this balance about when I couldn't just be the beer writer that drinks alone with a dog by himself. That's like a very lonely story. So all the homebrew tours, really, they're fun to get out. And the homebrew tours, in case you haven't heard about them, the basic idea is that some of the best beer being made is in people's homes, as you well know. But you're not often getting a chance to taste it. It's usually your friend or a friend of friend that's doing it. So in this case, I set up a route of three different homebrewers, and then we go to each home one after the other, and you sign up and you buy a ticket. You don't really know where you're going to go. You just know where you're going to start. You have no idea who you're going to be with. And so the tour attracts everyone from Goldman Sachs bankers on down to lesbian couples on a date. And so it's this really great cross-section where everyone's really there for beer, and it just shows that beer is this great common denominator, that it cuts through everything else, cuts across social classes, it makes everyone get along, and beer makes you talkative, and beer makes you happy.
Exactly.
Beer is the lubricant for social intercourse.
Indeed. And other kinds.
why stop there?
I think the great thing about your homebrew tours, because Chris and I have both been on either by our individually or together, yes, yeah. That since it's New York City, you always pick a neighborhood or kind of two adjacent neighborhoods, and you can do everything either by walking or or with train or bus.
Yeah, or with a minimum of mass transit. The idea is just that on a typical Saturday, you're not going to maybe go to the Upper East Side. You're not going to go to Williamsburg. You're not going to go to Bushwick. You're not going to go to the Bronx. So it really forces you to kind of get outside of your shell, and it forces you to really go out and check out new neighborhoods. So A, you get to meet home brewers, drink fantastic beer, but you also get to think about New York City in a different way. And I think New York City, you tend to get caught in ruts and get caught in circles, especially in the weekend when you tend to stick around your neighborhood a bit more, and you're like, I just want to go down and get a coffee, get a slice of pizza, and I had a long, hard week. And so the homebrew tour, like one of my favorite ones, we start off on Roosevelt Island. And for the listeners, Roosevelt Island is caught between Manhattan and Queens. It used to be where they had, I think it was smallpox patients back in the...
And that's where the Spider-Man tram takes you.
The Spider-Man tram.
Oh, right.
So the idea was start on Roosevelt Island. Like, most New Yorkers would not go to Roosevelt Island because it's really tough to get to. But we started there, had some fantastic beer, and then we all rode the tram together to the Upper East Side. And so it was just this quintessential New York experience, like going to the Empire State Building, Rockefeller Center, that you maybe not would do because you're like, ugh, I don't want to do it. I'll be here forever, but we're not all here forever.
Yeah.
Right. I also love that because I met several people who met me from that from a couple of those tours who weren't brewing then but then did brew, and I think it was really eye-opening for a lot of people who thought they couldn't brew in small spaces or less
spaces. I think
it kind of demystified the art of
homebrewing. It cuts two ways. You have there's homebrewers on there that I almost want to start this alumni club of homebrewers who have been on the homebrew tour that have gone on that have gone on to start their own breweries, like for instance Rich Casita up at Single Cut in Queens. He was originally on my homebrew tour. Josh Fields. Josh Fields, Sean Connor opened up Connor Fields in Oregon, and then now we have Finback Brewery opening up. And it's just one thing after the next.
And Chris Prout is going to be
brewmaster. Dirk the Norseman. Yeah, so it's great to watch all this evolution, but it's also on the tour. I would say only, it's only maybe about, of the 30 people on there, maybe only between like 5 and 15 at the most are homebrewers, but you watch everyone see that happen and how great it is, and the sharing and the community aspect that makes them really want to on a homebrew as well.
Yeah, I think this kind of thing is one of the things that makes your writing so great. You seem very in touch with the people. You're not from any one particular angle, and you just have a lot with that. And so this book that you recently wrote called The Complete Beer Course is to a target audience of...
Oh, we got to do that. Let's see. we got a few minutes on here. So, basically when I was traveling around with my first book, Brewed Awakening, which is kind of the story of the American craft beer and how it's really been changing the way that America drinks and in turn influencing the world, the more I was touring with that book and traveling, I realized that we kind of get caught in craft beer bubbles. And by that, that we don't really, that we're kind of surrounded by people that know what an IPA is, know what a double IPA is, know what an Imperial Stout is, and all these things. But that's still only 7% of America. Even within that 7% of people that understand what those things are, there tends to be a loss of the basic styles, which homebrewers are pretty well versed in, like Kolsch alt beers. But most of America, when the beers don't really have these giant fireworks surrounding it, it's really tough for people to get in, because it's almost, you almost need that 180 experience like an IPA will do, where it's an elemental flavor. You have that bitterness when the core human taste, and you're like, wow, I didn't realize beer could be like this. And so I think people go, it's human nature to want more chocolate, to want another double cheeseburger, another side of fries, to want more bigger fatty, just giant flavors. And so the idea, but there can be beauty and nuance. And so that's what I kind of want to do, is show the continuum of beer and how we start with, in a way, almost go from light to dark. By that I mean we start in Pilsner's lagers and kind of work our way up through Abbey Ales, wit beers, and then end up with the Imperial Stouts and wild yeast dose beers, and talk about the style's evolution over time, ground it in modern day, provide real world examples, and also basically the in a sentence, which I've gone over more than a sentence right now. In a sentence, I want to provide people the tools to walk into any beer store, bar, brewery, and understand everything on tap, from Pilsners to Gozas to those Imperial Stouts. And so it's just arming people with the knowledge and just cutting through the mystery.
Yeah. It's if you have to classify stuff, it's good to have a guide and know where it is. All music doesn't fit into one genre or category, and the same thing with beers. But having these categories, whether you believe in them or not, as an artist, if you hear a melody or think of a flavor, you just want to make that flavor, no matter where it falls in with the style guidelines. But those styles are there in order to guide the reader or the listener. The drinker or the listener.
That's one of my big things I was trying to talk about in there. I think I wrote in the book that I treat styles kind of like an elastic waistband that can kind of stretch to encompass a wide variety, because I think that nothing is going to fit neatly in these parameters. Not everything is going to fit the BJCP guidelines. But you need a starting point, and you need a framework to understand why things bounce off from there. And so you just can't, you can have fusion, but you need to know where the fusion begins. And so, and I think that's what, you know, there's a lot of talk about styles, utility of styles with everyone being so innovative. But I mean, you just need some basic sort of grounding to understand if you're calling this like a stout, like why, like a blueberry Chipotle stout, like what does that mean? But where does it start? And like, where did that begin and how does it go from there? And so I think, I'm not saying that things need to fit in neat boxes, but you need to know like why the box exists in the first place.
Yeah, I agree. And I think, so I took the BJCP courses when I first started homebrewing back in 2006 and took the exam. And I loved it, but I carried, you know, those, before our iPhones, I carried those guidelines with me everywhere. And I wish that I could have had your book because I learned a lot. I think I trained my palate and I just gave myself, I mean, I ended up, you know, within a year or so brewing nothing but bizarro beers that didn't fit any BJCP style guideline, but it was just great to learn kind of the basic styles, the basic framework of flavors and aromas and, you know, yeast character and hop character. But I think it's important to have, your book really gives people a sense of place. I think learning the history of a style and how it's evolved over time and, you know, where it comes from as far as, you know, even when it's jumped across oceans or whatever, I think that's really helpful. Even when you're just developing your palate and thinking about flavors and aromas, just knowing the history gives it more of a sense of place.
Yeah, and you know, like I try to treat, you know, history can be boring for a lot of people, and I fully understand that. I know it is.
I love it!
I know, but I think the challenge for me was taking these styles and making them come alive, and making them come alive in a way and not, I mean, I'll be honest, you could write an entire book about IPA, and Mitch Steele has written an entire book about IPA, but for the average drinker going into it, they just want to know why things are, how they go from there, and how they start, and how they led to there, why things are bitter, you know?
Yeah.
It's funny, you know, I just did a tasting, was it last week, and someone was like, so what are hops? And, you know, it just goes back to that even within beer drinkers, there's a lack of basic understanding that I think oftentimes it's just you don't ask these questions yourself. If you get really dive into it, you really want to know, like, about the yeast strain, how they really mutate flavors, that yeast is 90% of flavor in the beer, how the water impacts it. But I think, you know, this needs to go back to the core for a lot of people that there's just, I think beer, when you first start drinking it, it's just beer. And it's just, it's not the ingredients in there. It's not, I think we learn to cook dinner better than we learn to make beer, what beer is all about, that we know mac and cheese needs all these different things to go in there, and how to make a hamburger with a hot dog, I mean, sorry, with a bun on there. And like, it's just, but with beer, there's just not really that, you're not trained from a younger age, and beer is almost treated as this thing you're supposed, it's like in the box on top, it's like your Christmas present, the thing you want to get, but you can't always get when you're a younger kid. Then when you finally drink the beer, you just like get, I mean, you're 20, 21, 19, 18, and you just want to get drunk.
Yep.
And you don't care. And so it takes a lot of, like, it takes personal searching, which doesn't always happen until later on.
That's true.
And I think, well, I this is my own soundbite that I quote myself on all the time. I guess, you know, there are two kinds of beer, good beer and the other kind. But once you find that kind, the other kind, or the kind that you don't like, it's important to kind of find out or put language to it and define that so that you don't choose that beer again at the bar, so you can continue to drink the beer that you like. I mean, that's why we have... That's why these styles.
Well, and you can communicate that to your bartender, too, right?
Exactly. Developing your language.
Yeah, I think this goes on to, you know, like, I'm very careful never to really, you know, there is nothing like, a Coors Light's an incredibly well-made beer. I mean, if a homebrewer were to try to make a Coors Light, you're like, hey, Bob, why don't you go back in your garage, make me a Coors Light? I mean, it's...
Very difficult.
But the quality of skill, but it's like almost like the pellet gun mentality, where you just kind of shoot, like, buckshot, like, hitting as many things as possible, as many drinkers as possible. And so I think I'm very careful never to badmouth that, because I grew up drinking stuff like that, as a lot of listeners did. But then,
honestly, I still enjoy one once in a while.
You know what? We got 95 degrees at Coney Island. I mean, it's gonna all you want.
Something. We were just in Mexico, and those light lagers work very well.
Bohemia, for my favorite, Bohemia is a beautiful. It's actually a beautiful pilsner. Yeah. I mean, that's something that. And so I think that's what goes back to, but I think it's just learning the flavors you like and being able to articulate them. And that's what beer offers you, is the ability to have these easily understandable flavors. Like, you know, you could say, I like chocolate, I like coffee, I like bitter, I like sweet. And then the bartender can really build off of that. But it's all about understanding what your palate is like. And I think the other big thing I always try to talk to people about is just that I can tell you a million things, that what I like, and everyone's like, what's your favorite beer? And I'm like, oh my gosh, like, what day of the week is it? What time of day is it? It's like, what season is it? But it's just what I tell them is wrong for their taste buds, because everyone's taste buds are unique. And, you know, people like Thai food. Some people think Thai food is too spicy. Some people want more spice in their Thai food. And so it's just all about what your palate adores. And you can train your palate within that, but there's also, I think, like we're talking, going back to a basic understanding why that flavor is there. And of course, it's delicate, fruity, light. It's not a bad thing because it's not an IPA.
Right. When I think, I mean, we all think about, oh, what do you want? You know, when Chris and I think about, oh, what do you want for dinner? We're going to go out for dinner. What do you want for dinner? Oh, what do you want? You never feel like the same thing. I don't want to eat a hamburger or pizza or Thai food 7 nights of the week.
Mm-hmm.
So this, the same is true with beer. Even if you have a favorite style or styles, you're still going to shake it up. I mean, you're never, so I think the more information that you have, the better off you are.
And that's why this book is so freaking awesome. And it's beautiful.
No, it's true, though. Book. So no, here's seriously. The thing. No, because, you know, I did the BJCP. I'm a national judge. I love reading about beer and learning about beer. But your book is actually excellent. And that's it. So the one thing when I read this is I was like, oh, man, there has to be, you know, those book clubs that read. And this is ideal for that because you could do a chapter with a group of your friends. Get some of the examples and go through them. I mean, it would just, I don't know, it was like meant for that.
Yeah, and one of my friends, like, not that I'm advocating Christmas gift, but of course I want my daughter to be to have diapers. But, you know, they were saying that you could, you know, give someone a gift for the book, then have like beers featured in the book, then it's kind of like the best gift ever, where it's like, you know, not another tie, not another something like that, not another whatever, but, you know, it's a gift people actually use and enjoy. So,
but I did, I read this cover to cover.
Oh, thank you.
I reviewed it for a magazine, but...
a magazine, but, to be named later.
But, no, I actually was very, very, I mean, it's... First of all, it's extremely readable, and it's thorough. I love it that you do, you know, the traditional styles that we all know and love, like Pilsner and Kolsch. But then you also have Gosses in there, and some of the newer styles.
I mean, that's where beer is going. Coming off the GABF over the weekend, I mean, if you walk around, you're like, it's still Saison's going gangbusters.
Pumpkin.
Goza Berliner Weiss and Brett beers. I mean, I can't even tell you how many Brett beers I had. You know, which is just such a, because everyone thinks, not everyone, not these listeners, but a lot of people think Brett equals sour. I think that's kind of one of the things that has been kind of, you know, it's not misinformation, but it's just you can only communicate so much to drinkers.
It's kind of a misperception, I think.
So in there, but Brett beers are just going to go gangbusters right now. I really see a lot of growth and possibility in there. I think some of the best ones I had were not events in your mouth. They're just like, it's like another flavor profile. And not something like an incredibly like tart, like a Flanders Red. That's something that's going to like scrape the enamel off your teeth.
Right. So you could have sessionable Brett beers.
You can. I mean, we're seeing that. It's kind of, you know, I mean, add sessionable to everything. It's like getting a fortune cookie. It's like add between the sheets at the end of it.
And on that note, we're going to wrap up tonight's show. So thanks a ton to Greg Doss of Y Yeast and Josh Bernstein, author of The Complete Beer Course, is his most recent book.
Where can I find it?
Oh, you can find it at better bookstores across country, Amazon, Barnes & Noble, and your favorite independent bookstore, and oftentimes your homebrew shop and breweries as well. And you can find me at joshuambernstein.com as well.
And you have some book signings and other things coming up, I know.
Oh my gosh, do I? I just came off the JBF, so I'm trying to think. I literally got off the plane like maybe 24 hours ago. What have I got coming up? I'm going to be at Captain Lawrence on the 26th, provided we don't have our baby before then. And then I'll be in 22nd in Philly. I need to remember the place on there. The brew.
You have a list on your website.
JoshuaMBernstein.com.
Everything's up to date on
and
there.
And if you already think you know all the stuff in the book, then get it for a friend because it's an awesome book.
And I guarantee you're not going to know everything. There was stuff I didn't know in there. I mean, not that I know everything, but it's very thorough.
That's what I pretend. Like, you know, sometimes I get quizzed. I go out and about. People are like, what about this brewery? Have you been to this? And I'm like, you know what? I'm like, I firmly admit, I'm 5'4", 445 pounds. I cannot drink everything. I will try to over the course of my day.
And Americans are making more beer than they ever have before, ever, since pre-prohibition.
Yeah,
more breweries now. That's so exciting right now.
2,500 plus as far as, and 1,600 plus in planning.
Yeah.
I mean, just New York City alone, we have at least like, you know, 10, 12 more coming online in the next year. And so, crazy times, but good times, best times.
A thousand cheers. Foment about it over here.
Foment about
it. Talk to you next week. It's the Cider Week.
Cider Show.
Woo! Cider. Woo!
Thanks for listening to this program on heritageradionetwork.org. You can find all of our archived programs on our website, or as podcasts in the iTunes store by searching Heritage Radio Network. You can like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at @heritage_radio. You can email us questions at any time at info@heritageradionetwork.org. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization. To donate and become a member, visit our website today. Thanks for listening.
Hey, it's Francis Lamb, host of The Splendid Table. Every week on our show, we talk about food and cooking and the meanings of food and cooking. We talk with the most interesting people in food about their techniques, their culture, and everything in between. Whether it's about how fried chicken took over the world or how Instagram changes the way people are actually eating. It's a food show where everyone is welcome. Come join us. You can listen to The Splendid Table wherever you get your podcasts.